I'm not exactly sure how I timed that, but it is exactly 1:30. Apparently I should be a DJ. All right, we're gonna go ahead and get started. I expect people will be filtering in for the next 5 minutes or so, but that's okay. I've got loads of stuff to cover here, so I wanna make sure I get started on time so we have time at the end for questions as much as possible. So, my name's Jeff Mieliff. I'm a program manager, currently in the Office 365 team, but I still work on Exchange quite a bit from an on-premises perspective. I'm responsible for performance and sizing guidance for on-premises deployments, and I'm also responsible for virtualization guidance for our on-premises customers. I have a session later this afternoon where we'll talk in some detail about virtualization best practices, and I'll also be covering some sizing guidance specific to that scenario there. So if you're interested in that, this room at, I think, 4:45, whatever the 4 o'clock time slot is, feel free to come back, and we'll go through that then. So do everything I possibly can to keep everyone awake after lunch. This is semi-dry material, so I'll do what I can to keep you all engaged. We're going to leave the lights on for a change. Hopefully that'll help a bit, too. So in terms of the agenda, I'm going to very briefly go through the kind of high-level impact of some of the architectural changes that we made in 2013. If you've seen me talk about sizing for 2013 before, I typically go through this. This is going to be a very brief discussion around that, though. Where I'm going to spend most of the time is really around the how-to section, how to size 2013, how to get from sort of a conceptual design to actually understanding how much hardware you need to go out and purchase. Or how much hardware you need to plan to purchase over time as you grow your system. And we'll talk through some of the tools that are available as well to make that easier. You'll find that a lot of the guidance that we have in this area is actually fairly complex. There's a whole bunch of formulas out there that I'd love you all to never actually have to calculate manually. So we'll definitely be talking about the server role requirements calculator today. That's definitely the way to go through this process. And there's some new information in there for Service Pack 1 as well. We are making some changes to our sizing guidance for SP1. We haven't talked about it at all before today, so you're the first folks that are going to be seeing that. And they are some relatively major changes. So I'll be calling that out as we go through so you can make a note of what those changes are. Then we'll briefly talk about some caveats, things that aren't covered by our sizing guidance. We don't cover everything, and it's important to be aware of various scenarios that might apply to you and your customers if you're working in a consulting role going through this process, where our guidance may need to be extended or have some additional overhead added on top for things like third-party applications. So we'll talk through some of that briefly as well. Talk about how to verify or validate that the plan that you've come up with is actually sufficient. Some of the tools that we offer for that. And then we should have time for a bit of Q&A. If we don't get to your questions, I'll give you my email address up here at the end. And also feel free to come grab me at Mappy Hour later. Buy me a beer. buy me a free beer, and I'm more than happy to answer as many questions as you'd like to ask me. So let's go ahead and get going. So 2013 brought with it some fairly significant architectural changes, right? So the title of this slide was originally, oh no, not that slide again. I'm hoping that most of you have seen this diagram at least once so far. If you went to Ross's architecture session, that could have been for some of you your first exposure to some of the 2013 architecture. But I'm guessing many of you in the audience have been through this many times. So basically, from a sizing perspective, we have three roles that we care about: mailbox, CAS, and Active Directory. Yes, some of you care about Edge. Out of curiosity, how many people here want to deploy Edge? All right, okay. You're going to have questions for me because I'm probably not going to cover it in as much detail as you would like, but happy to have those conversations after. Today, we're primarily just going to be talking about these three roles. In general, kind of the high-level view from a sizing perspective and a performance perspective of why we made these changes is really around what we consider balanced use of hardware. The team that I was on during the 2010 development cycle was really the team that began pushing the idea of a multi-role server being a best practice for deployment. And in all transparency, it actually started out as sort of an answer to the question of, well, why doesn't everyone virtualize to be able to take better advantage of hardware? And we looked at how the different components in Exchange were using CPU, memory, storage, et cetera, and realized that if we combined all those roles and they theoretically played nicely together, that that would be an alternative to virtualizing those individual roles and getting a similar effect. And we found that in general, those roles did play nicely together. And in 2013, we basically shipped that as a product. So Mailbox got a promo in 2013, basically took over a lot of things, and Hub and Kaz are now spending more time with their families. So when you think about benefits to this change from a Mailbox perspective, we simplify the deployment model pretty dramatically, right? We have this this role that's essentially used as a kind of a scaling unit in the way that you would have used a combined ratio of machines in 2010 together, but instead you're just looking at the mailbox role as one unit. Makes it easier to think about how you scale and how you grow. We get some benefits around how we utilize cache. I'm not going to go into detail on that. Happy to if you want to delve into that at Mappy Hour. And I mentioned the balanced resource utilization as a benefit. Now, I have this other column called considerations. I'm not going to call them negatives, because of course there are no negatives about anything that we do. But as part of this architectural change, we use more resources. There are actually more components running on the box. There are features that we've added in 2013 compared to previous releases that require more resources. I've worked in the performance space for 15, 16 years-ish, almost 14 of those at Microsoft, and I'm well aware that as you release new functionality, sometimes you have to pay for it, and sometimes you pay for it in the form of more hardware. And that's the case with 2013. There are definitely some things that we've done that require more resources. In addition, everything on the box interacts, right? In putting so much functionality, so many of the Exchange components on one box, we have to make sure that everything plays nicely together. And so we have components on the box in 2013, sort of under the umbrella of workload management, that actually do some work behind the scenes to make sure that we're taking the best advantage of hardware possible, and at the same time providing a great end user experience. Basically making sure that we're always optimizing for client experience and delaying work that isn't necessarily critical at any given moment in time. That's actually, for those of you who watched the keynote, specifically the Ask Perry session, Perry talked about taking advantage of some of that underutilized hardware that we have in our data centers, right? Looking at those peaks and valleys of utilization. Well, workload management is essentially doing that in your on-premises deployments today, and trying to fill in some of those valleys with that background work. Perry talks about that being, sort of a future thing for some of the big data analysis work that we're doing, but we're also doing that for, store maintenance tasks, basically, on your servers as well. UM is also deployed on all of these mailbox servers. That's a fairly new thing. Another quick question. How many folks actually use UM? That's awesome to see. I used to ask that question 2 years ago, and I'd maybe get one hand. So that's very cool, and it makes me feel a little bit better about the fact that we're deploying it on all the servers. If it was just one person, that wouldn't be so good. But that brings up some caveats around sizing that we'll cover in a few minutes. So Kaz went off to spend more time with its with his family, but Kaz is back. Well, Kaz is very different in 2013. As I say here, we reincarnated it as a proxy. Kaz isn't doing the work that it did in 2007 and 2010, where it was actually performing some business logic, rendering user interfaces in the case of OWA, transforming content, doing a fair amount of work. In 2013, it's really just a proxy. And there's a number of benefits to that. You could think of it as being the component that's responsible for ensuring that connections get to the right place. In 2010, That was your load balancer, right? We realized fairly late in the game that we had a very hard dependency on load balancers in 2010 to make sure that that session affinity worked properly and that connections got to the right place. In 2013, CAS is what's doing that. It's doing authentication, and it's making sure that the connections get to the right place. But basically, that's all it's doing. So it has a very low resource footprint. It doesn't use a lot of resources. And you hopefully attended Ross's architecture session yesterday. And I hope if you attended it, one of the things you walked away with was the idea that every single person out there deploying Exchange 2013 should be deploying multi-role. I'm going to come back to that in a few slides, but that's a key message. CAS isn't doing a heck of a lot, and that makes it very easy to justify consolidating with Mailbox. You get some great benefits out of it. Like I said, I'll talk to that in detail in a few slides, but just keep that in mind. It does essentially add some performance cost, since the work that CAS is doing in 2013 didn't exist in 2010 or any prior role. It's new. So, yeah, if you go add up all the CPU that's being consumed by different roles in 2010 versus 2013, yeah, it's higher in 2013, no question about it. And this is one of the things responsible. So that's my very brief overview of kind of net impact. Let's talk about the nitty-gritty that's actually the content of the real content of today's session, and hopefully the reason that you're here. And that's how to actually think about going from a set of requirements, you know, some number of users, some profile of those users, how many messages they're sending, mailbox sizes, those types of things, and actually turn that into something real. Turn it into something that you can go to your hardware vendor and say, hey, this is what I need to buy. So the first thing I want to call out is that you should absolutely use the calculator. I mentioned this at the start, I mentioned it now, and I'm going to mention it at the end. This is a complex process. It's not designed to be easy, but the calculator is designed to make the process as easy as possible for you. So I can't emphasize it enough. We want everyone going through the sizing process to go and download the calculator and use it as a first step. Now, the documentation that's out there on the blog today for sizing 2013 defines all of the formulas that are used behind the scenes in the calculator. This is the first release where Ross and I really worked very closely together, rather than kind of in separate rooms and going off in slightly different directions. And we made sure that all of the examples in that blog post are perfectly aligned with what you get in the calculator. So if you're wondering why you know, some number is coming up in the calculator, you should be able to go and perform those calculations manually using the instructions on the blog and get to the same answer and better understand why the calculator is telling you what it is. You can also go in and explore the formulas with Excel if you really want to. Loads of fun. So around the calculator, it has some great features and functionality. So from my perspective, I think probably the most powerful thing about the calculator is it lets you go in and model the impact of different changes on your deployment. As an example, I might have 15,000 users in my company. What happens if I grow my company and add 5,000 users? Does that mean that I'm just going to need some additional percentage of hardware? Well, that's a fairly complex question to answer. Right? You're probably going to have servers in a DAG replicating to each other for high availability and disaster recovery. The way the DAG is deployed, the way the storage is laid out, the way the database copies are configured, all that's going to play into how much hardware you really need to add 5,000 users. The calculator lets you go in, change that number to 20,000, and explore the impact. And look at different scenarios. You know, if I want to suddenly bring up site resilience, if I'm concerned about disaster recovery, what is that going to do? Very simple to go in and take a look at that. So one important thing I want to call out here: if you use the calculator to size a deployment in 2010, and you go and use the calculator to size a deployment in 2013, do not go and directly compare results. I mean, you can certainly compare results from the perspective of how much hardware, actual hardware, I need to deploy, but don't directly compare the CPU numbers that come out. We used different baseline systems, basically, to come up with the CPU guidance. And if you just try and do an apples-to-apples comparison on CPU results, you'll probably go out and find, oh, wow, I need 4x the CPU for 2013 than I did for 2010, or some other very high multiplier. Those numbers are really misleading. It's not actually 4x or 3x or likely even 2x. It is more. It's absolutely going to be more. You're not going to be able to get away from that. But it's not that much more. So be careful with comparisons. That's caused a lot of angst with folks in the community since we released 2013. So important to call that out. So with that, I'm going to briefly show you a little demo of the calculator, and then I'm going to point out another session where you can get a lot more detail on the calculator, I believe tomorrow. So let me switch to my demo machine here. So this is the calculator. It's effectively an Excel spreadsheet, right? It's not really locked down. You can go extend it if you have other things you want to do with it. And I'm going to very briefly go through a fairly simple scenario here just to point out a few different features. So the calculator is actually pretty complex. There's a lot of knobs, switches, things you can change to get different results. Try not to get overwhelmed by those things. Many of you will go through the process of attempting to size an environment with this, and you won't need to touch 80% of the things in here. Ideally, the defaults that the calculator ships with are going to work for most of you. So the first page that you get in the calculator that I'm showing here, and I'm going to zoom in and out a bit just to make sure folks in the back can see. Try not to make you seasick or airsick or whatever here. But the first page is what you can think of as the kind of primary input page, where you tell the calculator about your specific deployment. You tell it about your user population, how they're going to use Exchange, what effectively your business requirements are. You know, what do you care about in terms of site resilience? How many database copies do you need to satisfy the requirements of your business to make sure that your data is retained in a reliable way? So we'll start with a few simple things. Server multi-role configuration. What are we going to do here? Exactly, yes. We are absolutely going to go with yes. And you'll notice that it's the default, as it should be. What are we going to do for virtualization? I'm kidding. I'm not going to ask that now. We're going to go with no in this particular example. It happens to be the default. You shouldn't necessarily read anything into that. Come to my session later if we want to talk about virtualization. And we're going to go with a highly available deployment. Exchange has some great high availability functionality built right in. We're going to take full advantage of that with a DAG. I'm going to scroll to the right here. Site resilience configuration is another thing that you will typically configure fairly early on. The default here actually used to be yes. I'm very glad we've changed it to no, because I like to start with something simple. Site resilience adds a fair amount of complexity to a deployment. And for this example, I'm going to leave it as no, just so I can get through this demo fairly quickly. But if you wanted to deploy site resilience, you'd set this to yes, configure the number of sites, configure how you want users distributed, et cetera. So we'll leave that at no. You'll notice here in these two cells that by default, the calculator is configured to contain 8 database availability groups of 8 servers each. I'm guessing that default doesn't apply to many of you. That's a lot of servers. So this is something that basically everyone's going to change. And we'd have to ask Ross why he sets the defaults to 8 and 8. I don't know. But I'm fairly certain for my company, which I'll go ahead and define now, 10,000 users, I don't need 8 DAGs. So let's go for 1 DAG. And we'll just say we'll start with 4 servers. I'll point out here that I had to configure the number of DAGs and servers. The calculator's not telling me how many DAGs and servers I need. It's an important point. I can go change it after I go and take a look at the impact of a given workload on those servers. I can go add or remove, but it's not going to tell me how many servers I need. So just be aware of that. I'm going to start with something that I think is realistic, and we'll see what we come out with. OK, so if I scroll down here a bit, I get to what we call the mailbox configuration, the different tiers of users. This is where I tell the calculator how many users I have, what type of profile they're going to run with. So the default here also doesn't, for number of users, also probably doesn't apply to most of you. The default's 100,000 users. I'm going to drop this down to 10,000. Go for a little bit smaller. Average message size, 75K. That's a pretty realistic average message size for most folks. Anyone run with a, that you're aware of, run with a dramatically larger average message size, like upwards of, let's just say, anyone run with a 1 meg average message size or higher? Yeah, one, OK. Usually get a couple. So this is where you'd change that. That can dramatically affect a number of different aspects of the sizing process. So it's great to have some visibility into what those numbers are ahead of time. And we'll talk briefly about how to get some of that data towards the end. Mailbox size limit, we set to 10 gigs. We like big mailboxes. We want everybody to deploy big mailboxes on large, cheap drives, JBOD deployments, you know, all those things that you've heard. Totally understand that not everyone's going to do that. So this is where you would go in and adjust the size limit to whatever you're actually aiming for based on business requirements. So I'm going to go for a gig. And that's all I'm going to change. I'm just going to go with the defaults for everything else from a mailbox profile perspective. And then really, the only other thing that I need to do is tell the calculator about the processing power of the servers that I'm going to use. This is really important so that the calculator can have some idea of whether or not I'm going to be able to fit into that processing capacity that's going to be available on those systems. So we use a benchmark called SPECINT 2006. So the SPECINT 2006 rate. SPEC is a group that kind of a consortium that hardware vendors publish their benchmark results to. And we take advantage of those benchmark results that are available on the web, on spec.org, to effectively determine for a given processor and a given server configuration how much CPU throughput do we get out of that configuration. So we have a tool out there, the processor query tool, that will go and query the website for you, the spec.org website, and tell you what number to use in the calculator for a given hardware platform. I'm just going to randomly, not really randomly, pick a number here and say 600 for the hardware that I'm using. And we'll use that to let the calculator tell me how I'm doing. So with that, the other thing that I'm going to do real quick here is actually change my, I forgot to change my my user profile. So I know from doing some research about my users that on average per day, they send and receive 200 messages. That's my user profile. In a business day, if I go add up the number of messages that each user sends and receives per day, that number is close to 200. So I'm going to put that in here, and we'll see what happens. So if I zoom out for a second and scroll down, we'll see that I've got some yellow highlighting down towards the bottom. If I zoom in on that, what that's essentially telling me is that the disk type for my database drives has an issue. I happen to know that the issue there, well, it's actually highlighting one thing, which is this this box over here on the right. It's telling me that the disk type that I've chosen won't work if I want to go with JBOD. The reason it's not going to work is that it doesn't have enough I/O capacity. It's not a disk capacity issue. In other words, I'm not running out of space. I'm running out of IOPS. If I was running out of space, we'd actually highlight the capacity column. So I could go through here and say, well, OK, that's great. I need to pick a different disk type. I'm going to go with more expensive drives. In this case, I don't know that I can get a more expensive drive with that capacity. So that then causes some issues. Or I can go and ensure that I have more of those disks, that I'm going to spread things out a bit more. I'm going to come back to that in a minute because I want to see what other problems I potentially have. So if I go to the role requirements tab, anybody overwhelmed by all this information yet? This actually shows, if I zoom into where it's highlighted, that I have a bit of a CPU problem on my mailbox servers. What it's saying is that in a worst-case scenario, a double failure scenario where I've lost two servers, in my primary data center, in this case my only data center because I'm not doing site resilience, I'm going to end up using 31 processor cores on my machines that have 16 processor cores. It's not going to work so well. Or to put it another way, I'm going to be running at 188% CPU. I wish I could run at 188% CPU. So I pretty clearly either need more CPUs in my servers or I need more servers. I already know that I have issues from a disk perspective. I know that I have issues from a CPU perspective, so let's add more servers. If I'm running at 188%, well, kind of sounds like I might just want to double my number of servers. So I'm going to do that. Thankfully, I have a blank check, so that's not an issue. And we'll switch to 8 servers, see what happens. So if I scroll back down, see, I no longer have a disk issue. If I go back to role requirements and look at CPU, I can see that I'm running at 79% CPU utilization in a worst-case failure scenario. And that's under our guidance of 80% being the ceiling for that worst-case failure. So I'm good on CPU. I'm good for disk. You may have noticed that it was recommending, I think, 256 gigs of RAM. It's come down to 96 gigs. I'm spreading things out a little more, so my per-server RAM utilization comes down fairly dramatically. And that's a fairly simple example of how you could use the calculator to look at a particular scenario and then change things up a little bit to see how the system would respond given those changes. There are a lot more things that you can do here, clearly. A couple that I want to call out real quick before I move on as we scroll through these tabs. So activation scenarios is essentially going to show you from a DAG perspective, as failures occur, what's the impact going to be on the system? So how many active mailboxes am I going to have after failures occur? I can see that in normal runtime, I'm going to have 15 active databases. Oh, to be clear, the calculator is going to make a recommendation about number of databases to use, optimized for storage configuration and the type of disks that you're using. So that's another great advantage. But what it's showing here is that in normal runtime, I have 15 databases with a total of 1,250 mailboxes per server, and calculating for me how that changes as failures occur. It'll also fill out this distribution tab for me. So it'll actually go through and show me for each one of the 8 servers in my deployment. These are the servers in columns. How things will change in terms of database activation. These are databases in rows. If I go through and fail things. So this is normal runtime distribution of how I'm configured from an activation perspective. If I go in and fail a server, this will go through and show essentially the change in activation, where things are going to go based on recommended configuration. And I can go through, if I have site resilience configured, I can fail the LAN basically do an entire site failure and see the impact there. You'll notice that there's some export options here. You can actually have the calculator export PowerShell scripts that'll go through and create these databases and configure things for you. So taking essentially our best practices for how we want things laid out, how we want activation preferences configured, et cetera, the calculator will do that for you. It's another great benefit. So with that, I'm going to stop talking about the calculator and go back to some of the more theoretical discussions here. But I will point out that if you're more interested, or if you're interested in delving into the calculator more, Brian Day, one of my teammates, is doing a session tomorrow called Tame the Beast. So we've nicknamed Brian the Beast Tamer. Highly encourage you to go check that out. It's unfortunately happening at the same time as a number of other great sessions, which is kind of a running theme for this conference so far. But if you have an opportunity, this is the place where you can really delve into some great specific scenarios and bring up your own as well to understand how those would get modeled in the calculator. Okay, so let's keep moving here. So multi-role, mentioned it multiple times. I'm gonna mention it again. Just do it. There are very few reasons not to multi-role. It absolutely simplifies server deployment. You just have a single unit of scale. Deploy as many of them as you need. Don't think about how to scale those roles separately. Just deploy the combined solution. You do get a benefit around increased availability. I'm assuming, I didn't attend Ross's session. I'm a bad teammate. I'm assuming Ross covered that, so I'm not going to go into great detail about that. But effectively, you end up with more servers running the CAS role, and so you are better able to handle failures happening at that layer in the stack. We've got more CAS around, more CAS available, so that we can essentially deal with more failures. We do still have the issue that we had in 2010 as well around an incompatibility between Windows network load balancing and Windows Server failover cluster. So if you're going to run Windows NLB, please don't, but if you're going to, for load balancing, this is going to be a problem. You basically cannot run Windows NLB on multi-role servers in a DAG. That's the incompatibility. So I'll say it again. Please don't run Windows NLB. It doesn't scale very well. We're not huge fans of it. It doesn't do any health monitoring of your servers to bring CAS in and out as needed. We'd love to see folks either take advantage of their existing load balancer investments that we unfortunately forced you to make for 2010, or deploy a layer 4, very simple, cheap load balancer that's not doing any affinity, not doing anything fancy, but at least can do some simple health probes to pull servers in and out as required. That's the way we'd like to see that go. And then the only other thing that I'm just briefly going to mention, some folks have called out certificate management being a concern here in basically two senses. One of them being we have more CAS servers, so now we just have to deal with more servers for rolling certs out, making sure that we've got the right certs with the right names, with the right expirations. That's one issue. The other is we have seen customers who have certificate authorities who charge on a per-server basis. You have more CAS, which means your cert costs go up. And if that's the case, get a new certificate authority. That's the advice there. Okay, so multi-role, just do it. Keep that in mind. So minimum requirements. They went up. In 2013, they went up pretty dramatically. Minimum disk space went up because we're doing a lot more logging by default. A lot of that is really good logging. We're logging some great diagnostic information from a perf perspective to the install drive. We're also logging a lot of other diagnostic information that's great to have access to if you run into problems. And I think over time, you'll see more and more tools, both from the product team, as well as our partners, as well as the community, that go through and parse that information and give you usable statistics to help you understand how your users are talking to Exchange and the experience that they're having. So we love having all that information there, but we're going to keep using more disk space on that drive, essentially. And then for those of you who deploy test labs, highly encourage you to have a lab environment where you can test things before you go into production. These are typically done on VMs these days. Why wouldn't you? In 2010, those were often done on really small VMs with small memory sizes. And if you try and deploy Exchange 2013 on like a 2 gig VM, you're going to be in for a world of hurt. We need at least 8 gigs of RAM to really be happy. So keep that in mind. We like memory, but it's cheap. It's cheap these days. So capacity requirements. One of the first things you need to figure out when you're sizing for Exchange is how much data do I have that I need to store, right? Exchange, behind the scenes, it's really just a giant database of content, right? We have a bunch of different things that sits on top of that database that transforms that information and provides different tools for manipulating that information, but we're really just a database. So thinking about the amount of content in the database and ensuring that we have enough copies of it for resiliency is one of the first places that you start when you're thinking about sizing. So space on disk is really about the content itself. You can think about that as the number of messages in all your users' mailboxes multiplied by the average message size, right? It's a fairly straightforward calculation. And then you have to think about content indexes, space for logs, space for overhead, for dealing with moves. There's a number of different overhead components that come into play. The calculator handles all of that for you. So ideally, you don't have to worry too much about that. But there's a few things I'll call out here. In 2010, in our sizing guidance, we had a fixed percentage overhead that we had a bunch of different names for. But essentially, it was kind of a fluff factor. We thought of it as the percentage difference between that first number that I talked about, that size of all your messages on disk, and what amount of space that database actually took on disk. We called that 20%. We changed the guidance in 2013 for that to be zero. And there are a couple of reasons for it. Unfortunately, there's another talk going on right now about storage inside information, or storage insights, and they may be going into some detail on that. But essentially, there's some compression work done and some schema work done in 2013 that results in that number being zero. And we've actually gotten some questions from folks who've been doing load-gen testing. They've gone and initialized huge amounts of content on disk and then come back to us saying, well, I completed the initialization process. I know all the content's there, but the EDB file on disk is dramatically smaller than the sum of all that content. You guys have a bug. And no, we don't have a bug. We're just compressing data really well. So be aware that the EDB file may actually be smaller than the sum of all those mailbox sizes. If you go run get mailbox statistics against all your users, add up your mailbox sizes, that EDB file may be smaller than that sum. That's not a bug. That's the way it is. So we give you a little bit of space back there. We don't actually commit to it being a certain percentage gain, because it's going to vary based on the content in those databases. But there is a bit of a win there. So there's a couple wins that I've described. Now I'm going to take it all away. So CI has grown a bit in 2013. We're now up to consuming 20% of the database size for content indexes. And it doesn't stop there. So CI goes through a regular process that we call master merge. It's basically what you could think of as CI background maintenance, background database maintenance. And for the master merge process, we actually need enough space on disk to write a new CI index. So we actually need 40%. We can mitigate that a little bit. For those of you who are considering storing multiple databases on a single volume, if you do that, and there are multiple benefits to doing that, I'm not going to go into all of them. That's covered in one of the high availability sessions. But if you do that, you actually only need space for one of those CI indexes for master merge. So if you have four databases, you're basically needing space for five content indexes versus eight, if that makes sense. So you minimize that that additional overhead for master merge. It's yet another reason that we like multiple databases per volume. IOPS. Not going to spend a lot of time here. We talk about it a lot. We reduced the IOPS requirements in 2013. They went down about 33% compared to 2010. I think we said in some of the marketing presentations early on, it was 50%. And that is true in some lab tests. But what we see in production is 33%, and that's what we're sizing on. We also made a change in 2010 where we had separate IOPS guidance for databases that were in a DAG versus databases on standalone servers. It was because of a difference in the way JET checkpoint depth was configured for those two different configurations. Checkpoint depth is the same in 2013 for all scenarios. So IOPS requirements are the same. Simplifies things quite a bit. So for transport, This is actually the first release in a while that we've talked in detail about transport storage requirements. I don't think we really provided any guidance for 2010. So very happy that we have this. Sizing transport storage is actually pretty straightforward. You need to think about space for mail in the queue. And you know, typically, we're going to have mail in the queue. Outbound internet content is not always going to get through, right? The internet was designed for that idea that there's going to be transient failures, and we need to be able to queue those messages and deliver them when we can. So for customers who already have an Exchange deployment in place, you probably have a fairly good idea of what, on average, you know, those queues look like. You can consider that. We also have this concept of safety net, which is you can think of it as the newer version of the Exchange 2010 dumpster. It's that space on disk that we use if we need to redeliver messages from a high availability perspective to make sure that we can do essentially lossless failures if we lose some database log files. So redelivering messages that that we need for high availability or disaster recovery. So safety net is essentially storing some period of message data. It's configured based on time. So it could be 2 days, could be 7 days, where those messages that have come through transport are just going to remain on disk. We're not going to delete them so that we can redeliver them if necessary. Obviously, that's going to have sizing implications. So in the calculator allows you to configure basically how many days of safety net you want configured. And allows you to define some queue parameters for how much data you expect to have in your queue. We find, in general, that storing your transport database on the system drive is a great way to go. And we think that the I/O reductions in Exchange over the last few releases let you do that, not really have to worry so much about what that storage is behind the system drive. What I mean there is you may be able to get away with having a couple of slow SATA or midline SAS drives mirrored for that system drive and use that for your transport storage as well. We've had a lot of customers deploy that way very successfully. We deploy that way internally, and it really simplifies transport sizing. So hopefully that'll work for you as well. So let's talk a bit about processor requirements. You'll notice the SP1 arrow. You'll see that throughout some of the upcoming slides. That's where certain changes are occurring for SP1. I'm not going to go into detail on this specific change. Just, you know, if you look at the deck later, it calls out that these numbers have changed. I will talk about it in a few slides down the road. Processor sizing for Exchange is done based on what we call megacycles. So a megacycle is a unit of work, essentially. You know, depending on the profile of your users, they're going to use more or less megacycles on the server. And that specint benchmark that I referred to is going to allow you to figure out, essentially, how many megacycles you have available to you and whether that workload will run on the hardware that you have. So what this table is essentially showing is that as the user profile grows, so as the profile grows in the far left column going down, the number of megacycles required for different scenarios increases. So the second column is the megacycles per user running on that server for an active database copy or a standalone if you're running Mailbox by itself. No one in here should be running Mailbox by itself. Everyone's going to run multi-role. So that second column doesn't apply to anyone. We can just ignore that. The third column that has the SP1 arrow under it or over it, that's the multi-role set of data. So that's the one that's going to apply to all of you. That's the one that matters. So you could think of this as you know, a number that you multiply by the number of users, and you know, you figure out the appropriate value based on the profile and get to a megacycle requirement. The calculator has all these numbers built into it. So it's going to figure that out for you behind the scenes. We're absolutely recommending turning off hyperthreading for 2013. For 2010, we suggested that you do that. for 2013, we're being a little more strong and saying you absolutely shouldn't have hyper-threading running. And the reason for it is around the way the .NET framework allocates memory. In 2010, we had some other reasons for it that I think were less of an issue. In 2013, we actually find that you're going to run much healthier from a memory perspective with hyper-threading turned off. And the benefit that you would get from hyper-threading is actually pretty minimal. You know, when we look at the pros and cons, we think that the memory win outweighs the CPU throughput benefit. You can run with it on. It's supported. But as a best practice, we highly encourage you to turn off hyper-threading. Now, there's some caveats to this from a virtualization deployment perspective that I'm going to cover later on this afternoon. But if you're deploying on physical hardware, hyper-threading should be off for Exchange servers. And we also have a couple of hot fixes that I like to point to while we're talking about memory that can pretty dramatically reduce memory utilization for the store worker process component running on, I was going to say your mailbox server, but your multi-role server. Highly encourage you to deploy one of these hot fixes, depending on the role of the version of Windows you're running. Unfortunately, these are hot fixes that are only available if you call into support and ask for them. They're not what we call GDRs, basically the hot fixes that are published broadly. So at the moment, you do have to call into Microsoft support to get access to these. We are working on trying to fix that. I've been working on that for a long time. Still haven't had any success, but we will get there eventually. These can have a very dramatic, on the order of hundreds of megabyte impact on decreasing memory utilization for Exchange. So highly recommend you deploy these. Memory for the mailbox components is actually sized in a very simple way. And it really has to do with database cache requirements. In 2010, it was the same thing. We sized memory requirements for mailbox based on cache requirements. And you may remember that the requirements for mailbox probably looked like exactly 1/4 of these numbers up here. And there's a very good reason for that. So in Exchange 2013, we used 25% of the memory on the box for database cache. So by using these numbers that are 4x what they were for 2010, we actually guarantee that we end up with the exact same amount of database cache per user for a given profile. We kept the database cache requirements the same from release to release, and these numbers ensure that we have that amount of database cache available. The other memory, the other 3/4 of that memory, is used for all the other components on the box, other than CAS, which I'll talk about in a second for those of you deploying multi-role, which is everyone. There's a formula that we have to use to figure that out. It's on the next slide. But this is actually a very straightforward way to calculate memory requirements. And then you essentially round up to whatever the next RAM size is that makes sense. So you're not going to deploy 63 gigabytes of RAM on a server. You're going to go up to 64. So when we think about CAS, CAS memory is actually sized based on a formula that is essentially 2 gigs plus 2 gigs per core of active use. And CAS CPU requirements are a ratio of active CPU use on the mailbox components to active CPU for CAS. So semi-complex formula here to figure out what that actual number is for multi-role. The calculator figures it out for you, so you don't have to. There is a slight change to this formula for SP1, and I'll explain the reason for that in just a second. If you are deploying a really weird Exchange configuration, the second half of the slide might apply. And by really weird, I mean very small number of users per database. So if you're coming from Notes and you really like the way Notes works with like a single user per database, You know, you could deploy that way on Exchange. Not telling you not to. It'd be really weird. But if you did that, you'd have to worry about these numbers down here. We basically have a minimum amount of memory that we require to ensure optimal JET utilization for databases. So just be aware of that. It's most likely not going to apply to any of you. Now, page files. This is new for SP1. It applies to Exchange 2013 generally. I've been getting a lot of complaints about our page file guidance. Anybody know what our current guidance is for page file sizing? Not you, Brent. Size of RAM plus 10 megs. So 2013, fairly big memory hog, right? That means big page files. Anybody like really big page files? Sorry, had to throw out the Sir Mix-a-Lot reference. So we're going to change that guidance today. And this will show up on the blog. So Ross was actually going to be in the front row. We were going to publish our blog post with our updated SP1 sizing guidance today. And I realized, since there's a couple changes in it that people might not like, that they may have thought it was an April Fool's joke. So we're going to wait until later in the week to actually update the guidance. So you're seeing it here first. Essentially, the new guidance is to cap the page file at 32 gigs plus 10 megs. So if you're deploying with greater than 32 gigs of RAM on your servers, you can now reduce your page file size, likely fairly dramatically. So the way to think of this is, you know, from an Excel formula perspective, it's going to be the smaller of RAM plus 10 megs or that 32 gigs plus 10 megs. We've been running this way in Exchange Online for quite some time, and we've gotten very comfortable with running servers at scale with page files of this size. So we think this is a good way to go. We think this will be a very positive impact for those of you that have been having issues with those large page files on disk. We don't like having the setting that allows Windows to manage the page file size. So I'm not encouraging you to go in and tell Windows to manage the page file size, yet cap it at this 32 gig amount. We actually want the page file size to be fixed. So Windows allocates that entire amount of space ahead of time, because we really don't want Windows to be out there growing the page file, which is a fairly expensive thing to do when Exchange is under stress, right? Even if you're using 2012 R2, this is, we're not talking about anything specific to any version of the OS. I will say that this is specific to Exchange 2013. We're not changing our guidance for down-level versions of Exchange at the moment. We may go there for 2010 at some point, but it'll probably be a different number than this. So just keep that in mind. This is 2013 specific. So there you go. Hopefully you're going to get some storage back, and that's a positive thing for you. Unified messaging is an interesting challenge for sizing for a number of reasons, not the least of which is this is probably all the sizing content we have for unified messaging. So hopefully you don't have any questions about this. UM is sized differently because typically you size a unified messaging solution in the same way you would size a telephony solution, based on a concurrency model. You know, what's the maximum number of calls that I need to handle in a worst case scenario, right? The way you size PBXs, essentially. And the way it's sized for Exchange is based on a concurrent call model. So UM will handle on the order of 100 concurrent calls per server. So 100 concurrent calls per multi-role server. And the challenge there is that in 2010, we were able to deploy UM as a standalone role. So if I needed to scale up the number of concurrent calls I was going to handle, I just added more UM servers. In 2013, it doesn't work that way. UM is installed on every server. And the server that's going to handle those UM calls is going to be the server that's handling the active copy of the database for the related user to the call. So what that means is you need to have a good understanding of how your users are using UM and potentially consider distributing your users in a different way to make sure that your mailbox servers are never going to exceed that concurrent call limitation. So that's about all the advice I can give you on that. I would be curious if people have run into problems with this. You know, feel free to come grab me after the session. I'd love some detail on that. But essentially, that's kind of the best we can offer at the moment is, you know, ideally figure out a model where you're distributing folks so that you never hit that limitation. Voicemail transcription, one of my favorite features of the product. I think it's one of the most entertaining features of the product. Very heavy consumer of CPU. Okay, it's designed to use, while it's performing its operations, it's designed to use an entire CPU core to perform that transcription. And it's actually smart about it. It'll go through and look at the current CPU utilization on the box when it needs to go perform a transcription. And if it doesn't have that CPU available to it, it'll skip it. It'll just send the voicemail audio file along to the user and say, you know, sorry, couldn't do the transcription. You'll have to listen to it yourself, and you don't get the funny email. So if that's a concern, if you absolutely have to have the transcription, you may need to deploy additional CPU resources or essentially spread users out amongst more servers to ensure that you've got those resources available on demand. So let's talk about CAS for a few minutes. We're getting towards the end here. So CAS CPU, like I mentioned, is sized based on a percentage model or a ratio of active CPU being used for mailbox to active CPU being used for CAS. So in 2013, CAS is requiring 37.5% of the active user megacycles on the mailbox components. That was a 75% value in 2010. If you are running a really small deployment, you may go do the math and realize that you only need one CAS server. That's the last point here. You don't only need one CAS server. But you are running multi-role, so it doesn't matter. But if you're not going to run multi-role, make sure you have enough CAS servers so that you can handle failure, basically. And the way the calculator actually handles this is to figure out how many CAS servers you need to meet the megacycle requirement, and then it adds two. Fairly straightforward. Then you can always handle two server failures. Very easy to think about it that way. So does anybody notice anything different about the numbers that I just talked through? Wow, okay. So there is something different here. That number used to be, the 37.5% used to be 25%. So we are raising our CAS CPU requirements for SP1. We're doing it by 50%, going up to that 37.5% requirement. And the impact is due to MAPI over HTTP, which I'm sure many of you have heard about. It's essentially a new transport protocol for Outlook connectivity with Exchange. It's disabled by default. So when you go and deploy SP1, MAPI over HTTP is not going to be used. It's a fairly major architectural shift. You need to make sure that you have the right clients deployed to be able to take advantage of it, and the right infrastructure in place to be able to utilize it. So we're shipping with it disabled by default, but we do want it to become the de facto connectivity method for Outlook communicating with Exchange, and that's why we're changing the sizing guidance now. We want folks to have the resources in place so that when you want to enable it, sooner rather than later, you can. So, key point here, this is not a requirement, or this is not an ask for those of you who've already deployed 2013 to go out and add more CAS resources. Not saying that at all. This is just a heads up for those of you in that situation that you may need to add more CAS resources before you turn it on. And for those of you who haven't deployed 2013 yet, the guidance change will ensure that you've got those resources available. So, as if I haven't talked about multi-role enough, one of the nice advantages to multi-role is that it minimizes the impact of this guidance change. So, bottom left corner, hard to see. We actually went through an exercise with some calculators from customers that we've dealt with quite a bit. to the level that we've actually helped them with their sizing process. Customer one there is actually deploying dedicated roles, and you can see that their sizing for RTM had them deploying 23 CAS servers per site. It's a fairly large customer. And you'll see, or maybe you can't see, but I'll tell you, with this guidance change, we're now saying that they're going to need 33 CAS servers per site. That's a fairly dramatic increase. It's a lot more hardware. They might happen to be a hardware vendor, so that may not be as big of a deal. Maybe. But let's compare that to what happens if we're deploying multi-role. So the other examples, and you should take a look at this, go download the deck off the Yammer site after. The other examples for multi-role actually show a much lower impact. So as an example, customer four there was sized in such a way that their servers were going to be running at 74% CPU at peak on these multi-role boxes. With the SP1 guidance change, that increases to 80. That means they have to do nothing. They're completely covered, no problem. There are a couple of examples here where one customer had sized to run at 94% CPU at peak. Obviously, that's not something we want people to do. They had some specific business reasons for doing that. They're now running at 102% CPU at peak. So yeah, they're going to have to change something there. But it's not going to be on the magnitude of the customer here who has dedicated CAS servers. That's the key point. So you're all going to use multi-role deployments. That's the point. The other thing I'll say here, absolutely deploy .NET Framework 4.5.1. There's actually a bunch of perf fixes in it. But there's one specific one that we're going to take advantage of for MAPI over HTTP. Very important to get that on your CAS server, CAS servers specifically, or your multi-role servers. So there's a session on MAPI over HTTP. If you have questions specific to what's going on differently within the protocol, why there's so many more, why the request rate is so much higher, et cetera, highly encourage you to take a look at that session. There'll be a great opportunity to talk to the development team around that topic. So when I was talking through multi-role memory earlier, kind of already covered sizing for CAS, but if you are deploying CAS separately, formula is slightly different, and that's really all I need to say about that, since you're not going to deploy dedicated CAS servers. We didn't change the AD requirements at all from 2010. Moving to 2013, they're really exactly the same. We continue to be happy with these guidelines. So we recommend having one global catalog core for every 8 mailbox cores. And we continue to recommend sizing RAM on those GCs so that it's large enough to essentially store the entire DIT or cache the entire DIT in memory. We get much better query performance that way. So that continues forward. And the last slide in this section that I'm going to call out, size absolutely does matter when it comes to Exchange. We haven't really called out a lot of specific scalability guidance for 2013 at this point. And one of the reasons for that is that we don't really know how high we can go at this point. We have done some testing internally, but we don't have very specific conclusive numbers that we've published that say do not run with more than n number of users on a server. That guidance does not exist. What I will say here is that when given the choice, you should always design for scale out rather than scale up. And you're gonna do that for a couple of reasons. Scale out, based on the Exchange architecture and the way we do high availability, means that you're going to be able to sustain more failures and still remain operational. Right? Everything fails. Exchange has bugs. Windows has bugs. Your hardware has bugs. All the pieces, all the components in your server box, other than from the CPU all the way to the storage, to disk controllers, to memory, they're all going to have issues at some point, right? Everything fails eventually. So you need to plan for those failures. And what we find is that the cheapest, most effective way to do that is to scale out on cheap hardware. So that's our guidance, and that's the way we do it internally for our large-scale deployments. So you get better alignment with our intentions from an architecture and deployment perspective. And when you think about where we're going to go in the future from an architectural perspective, you'll be better positioned to take advantage of some of those potential changes that occur down the road if you're aligned now with that scale out deployment method. So essentially what I'm saying here is don't go and think that because you can go and buy four proc hardware with 20 cores per proc, that you can then deploy 40,000 active users on an exchange server. You're not going to have a great experience. It's going to be painful, and it's probably going to be dramatically more expensive, even though you do get some space consolidation win. It's still probably going to be dramatically more expensive to deploy that way. So scale out as much as possible. That's our advice. So a few caveats before we close things out with some advice on tools. So like I said, we don't cover everything. The sizing model that the guidance is based on is really based on our internal production deployments. We don't run many, if any, third-party products in those deployments. So there are backup solutions, journaling solutions, mobile device management solutions, you name it. All kinds of products that impact exchange performance in some way that are going to impact sizing. And in general, what we're going to do is point you to those third parties to provide advice on how those products impact exchange. When that guidance doesn't exist, well, there are some options there, and I'll talk through those in the next slide. But you need to be aware that even though we are fairly specific about our hardware requirements here, you may need to beef things up a little bit. You may need to add some additional overhead to handle those third-party products. Line of business applications are another example that comes into play here. I got a question in the CAS Unplug session this morning. My company has an application that uses EWS. How do I figure out how many CAS resources I need for that EWS application, or mailbox resources, or multi-role resources? And the answer there is really to test it, right? And you can either test it in a lab or test it in production, depending on your ability to deal with that kind of activity happening in production. But you ramp up slowly, you monitor, you figure out what the impact is. That's the way that happens. There's no way for us to account for line of business applications within our sizing guidance. It's just not going to happen. So be aware. If you don't have guidance, there are a few different ways that you can deal with that. Over-deploying hardware certainly works. We tend to run just fine on too much hardware. You can do a pilot where you deploy, some small percentage of your user base, maybe ramp up over time, monitor, add more hardware if you need it. That's essentially the guidance here. So keep that in mind. So we've talked through how to use the calculator, where some of the numbers behind the calculator come from. Once you've gone through and gotten all that information, ideally purchase some hardware, we do recommend going through a bit of a test phase to make sure that you're good to go. So JetStress, I would encourage every single person in the room to run. Always, no excuses, run JetStress. You can use JetStress to burn in hardware, verify that your disks aren't going to fall over when you start moving mailboxes to them. If you go deploy a fairly large exchange deployment with a bunch of drives, chances are you're going to lose a couple of them initially in that deployment. We run with a lot of drives in the service, and some percentage of them maybe have issues on the truck. I don't know, if the shipping guy had fun with them or what, but you lose some drives. So burning in that hardware, great way to, JetStress is a great way to do that. But the thing that JetStress is really designed to do is take an I/O profile and confirm that the storage subsystem can actually handle that I/O profile. So some number of IOPS, JetStress will take that number of IOPS and validate that within the latency requirements of Exchange, those drives are capable of performing as required. It'll go create databases for you, run the test for some period of time, and produce a report that's actually pretty straightforward about any issues that it found. There is another JetStress session, J- Jestra-specific session, but I want to say is this afternoon. I'm not 100% positive on that. Neil Johnson is one of the speakers. If you're interested in more detail on JetStress, check out that session. But simple, straightforward, everybody should run JetStress before you go into production. Related to JetStress, we have a program called the Exchange Solution Reviewed Program that uses JetStress as a tool. And it's essentially a program that our partners in the storage industry are participating in to build realistic solutions for Exchange and then validate using JetStress that those solutions are capable of meeting a given user profile. So if you go check out the website, the ESRP website, you'll see around 30 solutions that our hardware partners have submitted, gone through a very specific testing process. We've validated that they've gone through that testing process properly. And you can use those as a starting point to configure 2013 aligned with best practices. We also have the load gen tool, the Exchange Load Generator. Don't use load gen unless you absolutely have to. I wrote load gen originally, so it's actually not very hard for me to say that. It's a love-hate relationship. Load gen is really complicated and takes a really long time to get working, and it's hard to interpret the results from it, frankly. Load gen has some very specific uses. It's designed to simulate client workloads running against Exchange, so Outlook, OAuth, POP, IMAP, SMTP, EWS, ActiveSync. Getting those running at scale, working together, is a hard thing to do. There are people that have built careers off of being able to run load gen tests successfully. So for small deployments, it's overkill. It's dramatic overkill. But we do make the tool available if there are situations where you actually need to have client load coming into Exchange and verify that that things are working properly end-to-end. And we released LoadGen 2013 last October, and we have another update. It's basically just bug fixes that'll be coming out very soon. So it does continue to be maintained, but the guidance is generally use JetStress, avoid LoadGen if you can. Okay? So quick summary of some key points, and then we'll have about 5 minutes for questions. And then, like I said, I'll be down at the Mappy Hour later if you have more. So, more hardware resources. Not going to lie about that. We absolutely require more in 2013, so be prepared for that. We're trying to give you more for that through managed availability, through some of the more user-facing features, and just the infrastructure that we're providing around availability and reliability, keeping the product up and running. Plan to deploy multi-role. I'm not going to say that anymore today. I'm done with multi-role. So I'll probably mention it in the virtualization session, but I'm done now. Use the calculator. Don't try and do this stuff manually. I will freely admit to the fact that when I wrote the blog post where I go through all the formulas, Ross and I went through at least 10 iterations of that because he and I had both made math errors on the blog post and in the calculator, and it was a complete nightmare. So there's enough opportunity to make mistakes within all these formulas that can dramatically impact the sizing results. Use the calculator. Let Excel do it for you. It's way easier. Don't need to really mention this more than what I say on the slide. Third-party products can have a big impact on sizing. Don't scale up. Scale out. It's the way we architected the product, the way we recommend deploying. Wherever possible, scale out. And run JetStress. If you've got more questions about the formulas, about the guidance, that nice long URL at the bottom is where you can get the sizing guidance blog. That'll be updated, like I said, not today, but later in the week with the new SP1 numbers. So you can take a look at that there. And I will take a couple of questions. We've got microphones up in the middle of the room. If we don't get to them today and you can't see me at Mappy Hour, email address right there as well. Yes?
Hello.
Hi.
You mentioned tuning .NET for stored KV oracles and hotfixes for 2008 R2 and 2012. Is there one for 2012 R2?
I had a feeling I was going to get that question. I was actually looking to see if we had that fix available for 2012 R2 right before this session. I'm still looking. So send me an email.
Yeah.
Basically, we'll get the guidance online updated, but I can get you the answer immediately once I get it. So yeah,
cool.
Reach out. Anybody else? Yep, can you use the mic just so we can get it recorded?
Will the calculator be updated when the new size and guidance
comes out? Yes, the calculator will be updated, and we'll, we actually have already done the updates, so they'll be released at the same time as the guidance update on the web. Yep.
So with the 2010 calculator, it provided you the minimum number of CAS servers you needed for your solution, and then we also had to go out to this white paper to use all these other calculations to get the CAS server numbers correct.
Yep.
Is that the same scenario with the 2013 calculator? You have to use both?
No. What we've attempted to do is simplify things. So the CAS calculation for 2013 is just going to give you the one number. You just use that. The 2010 guidance that you're referring to was a white paper, I think, that described the different impact of different types of clients. What we've attempted to do with the 2013 number is have enough overhead in the guidance that we account for the vast majority of clients. There's another session happening. Boris Levitsky is going to be doing a session where I believe he'll be describing some differences in clients and how to account for those if you have like really extreme client profile changes or if you're running a lot of third-party products, how you can think about applying some of that guidance. But in general, we think that the number that the calculator gives you should account for most scenarios. Yep. And this will be the last one, and then we'll adjourn to Mappy Hour later.
Okay. I actually have two questions, so I'll make it really quick.
Okay.
You talked about do multi-role. I don't mind sizing for all of that, but I don't use UM. So can I kill that service?
You can turn off services, absolutely. I don't know that we have any guidance out there that says, you know, here's how to do it in a way where managed availability won't care. So I personally don't know if just disabling the service is going to be all you need to do. But yeah, I mean, there's nothing to prevent you from going in and setting the service to disabled and seeing what happens.
And the other thing was, in an earlier session, they talked about in 2013 that the mailbox sizes are going to expand by 40%. But they had a little note that said, doesn't increase disk space. I think that I caught the reason why here when we were talking about that you do a better job on compressing stuff in the database.
Yeah, so there are a couple of things that changed. One of them, probably the change that you're referring to, is a change around the way we account for disk space, actually. So if you run Git mailbox statistics in 2010 versus 2013 for the same mailbox, you'll actually see 2013 showing that mailbox is dramatically larger than it was in 2010, when in reality it's the exact same data. That's just an accounting thing of us being able to have a better idea of some of the non-mailbox item information that's still in the database that's associated with that same mailbox, and you know, better able to account for, you know, which user essentially that metadata is associated with. So that actually has nothing to do with compression per se. That's just it's a change in, you know, the math that's happening behind the scenes to account for, you know, some of the other content. Sizing doesn't change. Yeah. Okay, I'll do one more, and then I really have to cut it off.
Just a follow-up to that. Is the overhead still about 30%, or is that changed with SP1 with the sizing mailbox statistics difference between 2010 and 2013?
So the 20% overhead number that we had in 2010 is now zero.
Sorry, you're going to get mailbox statistics.
Oh, I see what you're saying. You're asking if there's a difference between 2013 RTM and SP1? Not that I'm aware of.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, everybody.